Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new poll that finds the overwhelming majority of Trump supporters believe he is honest and trustworthy and will keep his campaign promises. At the same time, they do not believe the mainstream media, with 78% of Trump voters believing that news organizations regularly produce false stories. Ben Schreckinger, who covers national politics for Politico, joins us to discuss his latest article at Politico magazine, Trump's Fake War on the Fake News, and the paradox that while Trump's lies are working with cynical perfection on his base, he also wants the approval of the mainstream media that he demonizes as he spends a lot of his time obsessing over how he is covered and how his underlings like Sean Spicer are performing on his behalf. We will also look into the trickle-down nature of the culture of lying in the White House that has junior staffers routinely lying to the press just for fun. Then we'll gauge the reactions to the highly touted but thinly supported tax cut and tax reform proposals announced at the White House yesterday and assess the impact of the tax cuts on the deficit with Frank Clemente, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. He joins us to explain how getting rid of the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax while cutting the corporate tax to 15% will benefit Trump and enrich him, his family, his friends, and members of his cabinet. Then finally, we'll get an update on the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where the son of a top official in the Maduro government made a heartfelt appeal to his father on video, begging him to, quote, to end the injustice that has sunk this country. Jennifer McCoy, a professor of political science at Georgia State University and author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela and International Mediation in Venezuela, joins us to discuss plans for an intervention by the Organization of American States that may come too late as this heavily armed country is poised to descend into violent chaos. And joining us now is Ben Schreckinger, who covers national politics for Politico and previously wrote for Slate, Newsweek, The Atlantic, The Boston Globe, Boston Magazine, and The Financial Times, among others. His latest article at Politico magazine is Trump's Fake War on the Fake News. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Schreckinger.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, Ben, there's an extraordinary paradox here, and it comes out in your article that we just learned from this new poll by the Washington Post and ABC that Trump's supporters believe him overwhelmingly and don't believe the mainstream media. And yet Trump, while he plays to his base and feeds this endless blizzard of lies, at the same time, the mainstream press that he castigates, he tries to court, which he's always done throughout his entire career. So what is the game that's going on here? On the one hand, he's got his base in an alternative universe. He's pandering to them, putting down the mainstream media. But at the same time, it's almost like he really, at the end of the day, really wants the mainstream media's approval as well. He wants it both.
Right.
He wants it both ways, in other words.
That's right. And I think there's an extent to which this is strategic, to which it's been a huge winner for him politically to beat up on the press. And at the same time, as with any presidential administration, in reality, you have to deal with the press. And so there's that political aspect to it. And I think that even more importantly for this administration is the personal aspect for someone like Trump. When he's trashing the press, he's venting his real frustration. But that frustration is so real and so palpable for him when he doesn't get the coverage he wants, because he loves the media. He loves to consume it. He loves to talk to reporters. We had a story up today that says where we have one of his advisors saying that that's essentially his favorite activity. And there's nothing more gratifying for him than the experience of successfully spinning a reporter, successfully getting a flattering story out there. So it really is a really important dynamic in understanding how this administration has played out so far.
Well, the way you describe it in your article, Politico magazine, Ben Schreckinger, in Trump's fake war on the fake news, is that it's sort of like what anthropologists observed in with the Dene people in Papua New Guinea, a form of ritualized warfare. And the Dene people are famous for having this ritual where they and the rival tribe in the next valley meet in a neutral territory and line up against each other and shout insults for all day long and fire arrows that are designed to miss. And if they actually hit somebody, then they have to forfeit somebody on their side. So it is a brilliant way to kind of vent, but absolutely do no damage.
That's right. And I think that when you look at some of these press conferences with the huffing and puffing on both sides, and I think it's been noted for a few years now that television reporters especially can grandstand at presidential news conferences a little bit in the way they ask questions because it's good for the cameras, and every network likes to be able to show a little clip of their own correspondent asking that tough question, even if every network ends up asking a president, you know, essentially the same question. So there is that theater aspect to it. And then towards the end, I talk about the fact that there are, you know, real grudges, the potential for a much realer conflict to blow up, sort of constantly lurking beneath the surface here. So far it's been mostly a fake war, but, you know, depending on the course of this administration, it could become more of a hot war.
But do you think, though, that the president, and this is, he wouldn't be the first president to do this, has also discovered the tool of distraction? In other words, he's clearly worried about the Russian story. And he certainly went to all kinds of lengths to get out from under that tweet where he called Obama a bad or a sick guy, falsely accusing him of wiretapping Trump Tower. And, you know, you could make the case that Devin Nunes' peculiar behavior was all a way to kind of distract that. But subsequent to that, he's fired a few cruise missiles at Syria, dropped a big bomb in Afghanistan, and threatened war with North Korea. That's certainly taken the Russian story off the headlines, not that it's not still on the back burner. So do you detect that at all?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely worth keeping the wag the dog scenario in mind. I think Trump, really better than most of our previous presidents, or at least recent previous presidents, understands the way that our overheated media environment works and understands the power of distraction especially. I think that you can go back to countless points during the campaign where Trump was getting hit hard with one controversy and said something new and outrageous that moved people on to another controversy. It's an interesting tactic, one that I think most people, most political consultants before 2016 would have really advised against, at least the way Trump does it, where he seems to at times purposely distract from one negative story by creating a new negative story all its own. But clearly he's done it in a way that's landed him in the White House, and there's no reason to believe that he would stop doing it now that he's there.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Schreckinger, who covers national politics for Politico and previously wrote for Slate, Newsweek, The Atlantic, The Boston Globe, Boston Magazine, and The Financial Times, among others. His latest article at Politico Magazine is Trump's Fake War on the Fake News. And it's a very extensive article, Ben, and one of the things that's really extraordinary about it is that this atmosphere, obviously from the top down, it's almost like trickle-down lying. When you have sort of staffers, even ones that are not that important, lying for fun to the media, like it's a sport, that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think that is really one of the more startling, eyebrow-raising things that I came across in reporting this piece, which is, you know, every political campaign is at the very least going to spin on questions. Many, if not most, political operations will lie to reporters at one point or another, usually to deny the existence of some negative episode, to deny some sort of scandal that really did occur. What's a little bit different about the extent to which the Trump White House takes it, according to at least three people close to the White House that have been warned about this practice, is that these guys will do it just for fun. Guys and gals will do it just for fun. Their attitude, as it's been described to our sources, is, well, you know, the media is just going to print what they want anyway, so we may as well have some fun. One very senior correspondent that we spoke to said that he was warned during the transition by a Trump official to be careful of really good details he gets on background from the White House because they're often made up. Shocking in some ways, but given that the boss is someone who, for much of the 80s and 90s, would call up tabloids, make up outlandish stories about himself, sometimes pretend to be his own spokesman, pretend to be someone named John Barron and calling his tabloid reporters. It's not surprising that, as you put it, that sort of form of lying has trickled down to other parts of the White House.
Well, those audio tapes of him pretending to be John Barron are pretty, pretty extraordinary to listen to. And the fact that Trump is obsessed with Spicer and his performance, and apparently takes time out of the day to actually watch the White House press conferences, which you'd think a president has better things to do, it's almost as if you were an actor, you're kind of more interested in the reviews than you are in your own performance. In other words, you know, like when a play is on Broadway, actors go racing down to Sardi's at 2 in the morning to get the earliest copy of the New York Times to see the reviews. It seems like Trump is more interested in the reviews of his performance, or in this case, Spicer's performance, than doing the job itself.
Yeah, that's spot on. And I recommend that you and your readers check out a piece that my colleagues put out today about Trump's first 100 days. Because one of the points they hammer home in that piece a couple of times is that Trump, when he's getting briefed on things, basically likes to be told how this is going to play out in the media. And that is a high, if not the highest priority for him as he's gaming out with his advisors what he's going to do. And more recently, since our piece has come out, the White House has started to put out a very similar line on Trump's view of Spicer, which is that the ratings are great. You can't beat his ratings, so his job's not in trouble right now. So, yeah, I think you essentially nailed that dynamic.
But what does it say about governance in the sense that if you have government by stunt, if the idea is to manipulate the press and get ratings and have good photo ops, and this may well happen at the expense of real governance, at what point does the public find out? Because, again, you go back to this Washington Post ABC poll, and it's as though there's an alternative universe where Trump's supporters are absolutely convinced that he doesn't lie and that the lying mainstream press lies. And it doesn't seem there's no crack in that wall from what I can tell.
Yeah, well, you know, politics to a certain degree is always going to have an element of theater. Trump has taken that to the extreme. He, for example, it was reported that he was basically casting his cabinet. He was deciding who had the look. John Bolton didn't have the look because he had a mustache to be Secretary of State, and so he didn't get the part or the appointment. What does this say about governance? It's most likely, in the final analysis, not the best way to govern. We'll find that out over a course of months and years, but certainly it's made for an entertaining form of government. People, both that walled off universe of his supporters who have sort of one view of reality and the people who don't support him who tend to subscribe to a different set of facts, I think can agree that they've at least both been transfixed by this administration so far.
Well, just to bring some statistics into this poll, because it's so extraordinary, the gap here. 80% of Trump's voters think it's a bigger problem that news organizations produce false stories, while only 3% of them think it's a bigger problem that the Trump administration makes false claims. 70% of Trump voters think the Trump administration regularly makes false claims, while 76% of Trump voters think he doesn't. 78% of Trump's voters think that news organizations regularly produce false stories, while only 19% of them think otherwise. And 84% of Trump voters think he's keeping most of his major campaign promises, while only 4% think he isn't. And 89% of them think he's honest and trustworthy. So that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
I mean, it is.
You know, that because the stuff that he says, I mean, you point out, of course, in your article about how, talk about Spicer, getting off to a shaky start. He was obviously, Trump made him go before the press and lie about the size of the crowds at the inauguration, which the evidence for which was just manifest and unambiguous. And yet he insisted, Spicer, that it was the biggest crowd in history. Isn't it amazing? It's just amazing.
It is amazing. We had some researchers, some Twitter researchers in from the MIT Media Lab this week, and they showed some journalists here at Politico a graphic of political Twitter that was grouped. It showed mutual follows. It showed this sort of constellation of active political Twitter accounts and who followed who. And the Trump supporters were all bunched up together on one side, and the connections between them were very dense. And then they were barely connected to the crescent that represented the rest of the political spectrum, which was all much more connected to each other. So you could sort of see these two epistemic systems that are pretty closed off from each other. So it's not just a media construct. It's not evident just in these poll results. You can sort of see the way in which these information environments are closed off from one another. And obviously that is not conducive to a shared public sphere.
So obviously you can identify the people that are a part of the kind of misinformation and shape-shifting of the truth. Spicer, of course, obviously doesn't want to confront his boss and has gone along with that, as we just pointed out from that extraordinary claim about the inauguration crowd. Kellyanne Conway has even said there's alternative facts. She seems to be a little bit more marginalized. But how does this approach, and Bannon himself apparently is a student of what the Russians call political technology, or a political technologist, Surkov, who was an advisor to Putin, who devised this method of shape-shifting and creating chaos and keeping everybody off balance, which it does seem to some extent Trump has borrowed from Surkov, or at least via Bannon. But at the end of the day, for example, the National Security Advisor has to deal with the reality, and so do the Joint Chiefs and these people. Their jobs are firmly anchored in the real world, with real world problems and, God forbid, real world crises. So how do you deal with that? For example, what would happen if GCHQ in the UK, which Trump has trashed, flashed to General McMaster that there's a real crisis going on, say, in Eastern Europe? And would Trump, when McMaster presented him with this, would he believe McMaster or would he believe Alex Jones?
That's a great question. The optimistic answer is that he would believe McMaster and that he's sort of, aware of the games he plays in terms of flirting with someone like Alex Jones and calling him respected and retweeting very questionable sources of information, outright dubious, outright false pieces of information. The real answer is that no one can say for certain, and that it's concerning that he's even given us, reason to ask the question. What's more certain is that at least almost certainly there's going to come a moment like that where we're going to find out, and we're also going to find out, the extent to which the administration will be able to mobilize the public behind a set of information that it presents during a crisis, or whether the public won't be able to quickly reach a consensus about whether to trust what the administration is telling it in a crisis. So we are sort of setting ourselves up for real potential problems, not if, but when a real crisis materializes.
Well, just in closing, Ben Schreckinger, the old expression is, of course, that eventually your lies will catch up with you. Do you think that the lies will catch up with Trump, or have they caught up with him? I mean, I frankly can't believe the word he says, because it's just been some of the lies have been such howlers that you almost have to laugh. But and the alacrity. And I understand he comes out of real estate, and he's a salesman, and, in that kind of mindset, resume embellishing and exaggeration and hyperbole are the rules of the road. But what's your sense of whether or not it's going to catch up on him?
I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows. I think it's sort of why we're all glued to the set, waiting to find out what exactly happens, how this all plays out. It's why the ratings for this presidency have been so good.
So maybe there's the answer there, right?
Yeah.
It's all about ratings. Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. This was lovely.
No, I enjoyed it. And again, I've been speaking with Ben Schreckinger, who covers national politics for Politico and previously wrote for Slate, Newsweek, The Atlantic, The Boston Globe, Boston Magazine, and The Financial Times, among others. His latest article at Politico Magazine is Trump's Fake War on the Fake News. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back gauging the reactions of the highly touted but thinly supported tax cut and tax reform proposals announced yesterday at the White House.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
I
learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frank Clemente, who's Executive Director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 230 organizations, and has also been a senior policy advisor to the United States House Committee on Government Operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Clemente.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Thank you. And there's been quite a reaction to yesterday's presentation by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and the White House Economic Advisor Gary Cohn introducing the Trump administration's historic tax cut, as Mnuchin called it, and tax reform, but it's more about tax cutting than reforming. So what's your sense then of whether or not they just had a piece of paper, one piece of paper with a bunch of bullet points? And the whole thing was so amateurish in the way that Mnuchin dismissed the reporter's question about Trump's taxes. Like, when is he going to reveal his taxes? And Mnuchin said, oh, he's revealed more information about his taxes than any other American president. And what next question? You know, it's like, you know, just the arrogance of these people is only met by their apparent incompetence. But at the end of the day, they're in power and they're going to help themselves, aren't they?
Well, this legislation is there's a lot of self-interest in this legislation on the part of the president. It's actually very similar to what he had put forward as a candidate back in October, and there's numerous ways that he and his family will be very advantaged if he is actually paying taxes. I mean, there still is the question about whether he's paying any taxes now or not, but on the assumption that he is paying taxes, there's some very large tax loopholes that are in the legislation that he's proposed yesterday that could save his family millions of dollars now and billions of dollars when Trump passes away and perhaps passes on an estate worth a lot of money.
Well, let's go through some of these proposals, all of which basically help him. You mentioned getting rid of the estate tax. And the other one, of course, is the alternative minimum tax. And, of course, the most egregious one is the S-corporation pass-through, which has the greatest potential for simply exploding the deficit beyond reach, because any wealthy person will then be able to call themselves a corporation, pass the earnings, their normally taxable earnings, through the corporation and only have to pay 15%, which is what the new corporate rate that Trump is proposing. So that's the first one, right?
Yeah, Yeah, the way that works for your listeners, it's interesting to know that President Trump, the Trump Organization, is not a corporation the way most businesses are incorporated. It's called a C corporation, and you pay the corporate tax rate, which is 35%. He is actually, the Trump Organization is a collection of more than 500 business entities, and the jargon is they're called pass-through. Pass-through means simply that they are not paying taxes as a corporation. Trump is paying taxes as a person. So it's money that's coming through his business to him, profits coming through his business to him, and then he is paying taxes on it at the individual tax rate. In theory, let's assume he can take no deductions. His tax rate at the personal level is close to 40% because he's such a high earner. But I'm sure, you know, we know he has lots of deductions he takes advantage of. But the way this pass-through rate works is, so rather than the hedge fund manager, for instance, who might be paying 40% now, they could incorporate themselves essentially as an independent contractor and pay at the 15% rate, which will be the new pass-through rate. Trump himself, his pass-through entities, will automatically qualify as being able to pay at this 15% rate rather than the 40% rate. So that's a two-thirds tax cut for, you know, a billionaire like Trump.
But that will mean that every doctor, dentist, lawyer, all of the high earners in the middle class, upper middle class tax bracket, which is the basis of the revenues that the IRS bring in, they'll be doing pass-throughs. So that's why I'm saying it will impact the deficit enormously, won't it?
Yes. Well, many of them actually are already pass-throughs. They don't have to refile. They are partnerships. They might be LLCs, limited liability corporations. People might see those initials after the name of the business or the doctor or the lawyer that's providing services to you. And so, yes, those folks, ordinarily they're paying taxes at the 40% rate. Suddenly they will now pay taxes at the 15% rate if the Trump plan goes through. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimates are that it would lose about $1.5 trillion over 10 years. That's a huge chunk of money. It's hard to understand that. The Medicaid program, that's about 2 years of, 2.5 years of fully funding the Medicaid program, which serves 75 million people. Just to put it a little bit in perspective, I know it's kind of hard to conceive of these numbers are so big, but you could serve 75 million people for more than 2 years on the revenue that might be lost from this one tax loophole that Trump wants to introduce.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Lametti, who's the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. He's also been a senior policy advisor to the United States House Committee on Government Operations. So let's turn. We know about the estate tax. That's obvious that that Ivanka and company will all be even richer than they are as a result of getting rid of the estate tax. But the alternative minimum tax, the best way to put that in perspective, I think, is that when the 2005 tax returns of Donald Trump showed up in David K. Johnson's mailbox, and to David's credit, he immediately assumed that Trump himself had leaked them, which is clearly what happened. I don't think there's any doubt about that, because it was a year in which Trump paid 25% tax on $153 million in taxable income. If the alternative minimum tax were gotten rid of, which is what he's proposing, Trump would have paid less than 4% instead of the 25%. So there you have it. I mean,
yeah, no, that's right. Actually, just a little bit more background. The reason we all, reason David K. Johnston and a lot of us think that this tax return was probably released by Trump himself is because reporters, news reporters, have investigated previous years through various means of how much Trump has paid in federal income taxes. And there are reports on 5 years. Some of this has been reconstructed through filings he had to do because of his gambling, his casinos in Atlantic City and some other stuff. Anyway, for 5 years, we believe he paid zero income taxes or a little bit of federal income taxes. And the reason we suspect that this came from him is, all of a sudden he was paying $38 million in income taxes, a 25% rate, which didn't look bad compared to a 0% rate. The way the alternative minimum tax is a tax that was put in place in order to ensure that millionaires and wealthy people pay at least some modicum of a reasonable tax because they're able to utilize a lot of the loopholes that are in the law, and utilizing those loopholes, it can, reduce your tax rate way down. And Trump is the perfect example, actually. You just described it. With the alternative minimum tax, he made $153 million in 2005. With the alternative minimum tax, he was paying $38 million in taxes. If the alternative minimum tax didn't exist, he would have only been paying about $5 million in taxes. So more than a $30 million difference in his tax bill with the alternative minimum tax in place or if it were repealed. And so the theory, and so, what's interesting or not so interesting, what is self-interesting is that Trump has proposed in his tax plan to get rid of this alternative minimum tax so that people like him would have to pay at least a reasonable amount of taxes, that they can't just escape their responsibility through the loopholes that exist in the law.
And then, of course, on top of the 15% corporate tax rate reduced down from 35 to 15%, and even Paul Ryan himself said that that's going to bust the deficit because it's not deficit neutral. I think he said something like 20%+ would be a break-even point in terms of revenues. But the other one, of course, is a territorial system that would let foreign profits go untaxed. Is that also going to benefit Trump?
Well, I don't know. I don't believe so, because as a C corp, he's not a C corporation, and the current we haven't seen any details. But my guess is that that's only going to apply to C corporations. It won't apply to
right. But that'll make his buddy Wilbur Ross even richer, right? And these characters in his cabinet.
Sure. Yeah. All these folks that are making their money off of it, their C corporations. We just put a report out about Wall Street, the six biggest banks on Wall Street, and I think we showed that they were saving about $50 billion due to the offshore tax loopholes that exist now, Trump does not close those loopholes. Unfortunately, he makes it bigger with the territorial tax system. And just so your folk readers or listeners understand the way a territorial tax system is, currently a U.S. corporation pays taxes on the profits it makes here in America and on the profits it makes offshore. However, there's this major loophole that allows them to defer paying taxes on their offshore profits until they are brought back here to America to the parent company. And that's why there's this $2.6 trillion in profits, U.S. profits, that are sitting offshore, in theory sitting offshore, and are untaxed right now. Trump basically wants to let corporations bring that money back, and he hasn't said what the tax rate will be. We believe they should pay what they owe, which is 35%. Trump is talking about a 10% tax rate or even less. So he's talking about letting them get a tax break of probably $500 or $600 billion that we will lose in what they owe on that money that's offshore. So that's on the current profits that sit offshore. It's a huge chunk of money that we could use to rebuild our roads and bridges and, invest in education, all sorts of great things. He wants to give it to them at fire sale prices. But then he is talking about going forward, how to tax these profits that they're making going forward once this sort of money that's offshore now that's untaxed gets dealt with. He wants to say, well, you're not going to pay any taxes to America on the money that you're generating offshore. And the problem with that is the high-tech companies, the drug companies, prescription drug companies, financial companies, banks, they're able to, through the loopholes that exist in the law, make their U.S. profits, shift them offshore, usually to tax havens. Most of this money is sitting in tax havens, to make it look like the money is not generated here in America. They're booking it in these tax havens, and by booking these tax havens under this territorial system, they will be able to get away without paying taxes on that money if Trump's tax plan becomes law. So we're talking about a massive loss in revenue in the future, potentially, if he goes to a territorial tax system. And not only that, it just creates much more incentive for corporations to go offshore with U.S. jobs.
So if Trump himself is not, I mean, Trump is benefiting, as we pointed out, from many of the aspects of these so-called tax reform. We've listed them so far. But the territorial one looks like it's going to be more of a benefit to Gary Cohn and the Goldman Sachs people that are also running the place along with Mnuchin there at Treasury. But the other player in all this is even more of a zealot. These guys, I think, are just out to make money for themselves and their friends, and they don't give a damn about anybody else. But Ryan is a little different. He's an ideologue. He's a believer in Ayn Rand's insanity. And he wants to destroy Social Security, and he wants to destroy Medicaid. And he this so-called repeal and replace of Obamacare was a stealth attempt to kill Medicaid. Now it's pretty clear that he also wants to kill Social Security in another stealth way, with this Trojan horse idea of giving the middle class a tax break by getting rid of the payroll tax that funds Social Security. Can this be smoked out, for God's sake? It's so transparent.
Well, I mean, I'm not... Who do you say is talking about getting rid of the payroll tax?
Ryan is.
I haven't heard that.
In order to give a temporary middle-class tax cut.
What? I've not heard that. Did that come out today?
No, it came out a few weeks ago.
That I don't think is on the... I've not heard of that. I don't think that that's really on the table. I mean, I do think that you're absolutely right about Paul Ryan. His agenda... Look, he wants very small government. He wants very low taxes, and small government means, and if you combine small government and very low taxes, it means he doesn't want the government to do very much, probably except for defend the borders, have a strong military, but he wants to do a lot of privatizing of our jewels, Social Security, Medicare. But the way to think about this is Trump, Ryan... Let's say their tax plan costs $5 trillion over 10 years. Now, the Republicans rail about big deficits and about the debt that the country has. And so on some level, they have to be held accountable to paying for their tax breaks. We know that they always make Democrats pay for, hey, if you want $10 billion for unemployment compensation for in the depths of the Great Recession, well, you've got to pay for it. So now they kind of are going to have to show how they're going to pay for their tax breaks. Now, they really don't want to have to do that. And it's unclear whether they're actually going to put it up in a very transparent way and say, okay, well, in order to pay for this $5 trillion tax break, in tax breaks, we're going to close these loopholes here, and then we're going to cut spending here, because you can't make up for all this by closing all these loopholes. That's the key question, and that's the thing that the public needs to understand, that the way they're going to pay for this stuff, they may close a handful of loopholes, but the big way they're going to pay for it is they're going to try and shrink the rest of the government, that is the benefits and services that people love about the government they depend on, Medicare, Medicaid. I don't think they'll touch Social Security in this debate. Medicare, Medicaid, education, rebuilding our roads and bridges, medical research, funding the EPA, on down the line, they're going to try and shrink all of these government services and benefits for folks in order to pay for these tax breaks. We're seeing it right now in the fight over replacing the Affordable Care Act with Trump Care, with the Republican repeal plan. That is not just a fight over health care, it's a fight over taxes and tax fairness. Why is that? Because they wanted to Obamacare rests on the way Obamacare works is it provides, it expanded the Medicaid program, and then it provided income support to families to purchase private health insurance through these exchanges. Where did the money come from in order to do those two big things, which is what insures all the people now? They raised taxes on the wealthy, and they made health insurance companies pay $145 billion in taxes over 10 years, and they made drug companies pay a whole bunch of money in taxes. That's how it's paid for. The Republicans want to wipe out all of those taxes, and the reason, and so when you wipe out all those taxes, you can't have, you can't provide the Medicaid to people, and you can't provide the subsidies, which is why the premiums are going to go up, the cost sharing is going to go up a whole lot. So that's how the system works.
Right, and that's what I meant earlier about this stealth way to get to kill off Medicaid was by taking away the funding base, which is to remove the obligation on the part of the rich to pay for,
that's right,
for the subsidies for the poor. So
there's huge cuts.
So check out though the idea of this Trojan horse about the social getting rid of the payroll tax. It wasn't offered by Ryan, but apparently it's in the works. So I'll look into it further too.
Well, there had been a rumor that Trump was considering that.
Right.
I hadn't heard Ryan.
Yeah.
The rumor was that Trump was. But I said to folks, there's no way they're not going to go there. It's too controversial.
Right. Well, everything they've done so far is so dreadful anyway. and that's what we've been talking about. And I thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Take care. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Clemente, who's the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was a campaign manager for the Strength and Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 320 organizations. And he also has been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the deteriorating situation in Venezuela.
Otra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Joining us now is Jennifer McCoy, who's a political science professor at Georgia State University. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Jamaica, Peru, and Venezuela, and has spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow. She's the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela, and her most recent book is International Mediation in Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you so much, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And there's certainly an unraveling going on in Venezuela. It has been going on for some time, but now it's taken on a kind of rather dramatic and personal note, where the son of a top Venezuelan official, in this case the government's ombudsman for human rights, the son is actually appealing to his father, because demonstrators have tried to go to the government's ombudsman's office and they've been blocked by riot police and tear gas, etc. And so the son has written, Dad, in this, or appealed on video, I should say, the son has appealed on video saying, Dad, in this moment you have the power to end the injustice that has sunk this country. I ask you as your son and in the name of Venezuela, which you represent, that you reflect and do what you must do. So what do you make of this? Is this just another example of this slow agony, or do you think there's some kind of turning point happening or about to happen?
Well, I think it's symbolically very important because it is, as you said, a personal and emotional appeal. I mean, for the son to appeal publicly to his father is quite something, particularly within the Chavista circles, the circles, you know, that do continue to support President Nicolas Maduro. It may not necessarily have an immediate effect, but so far, the ombudsman, the human rights defender, his father, has said anyone who has evidence of these colectivos, which are sort of the armed motorcycle gangs, actually shooting people, please bring them to me. So he has, you know, responded somewhat to this. This ombudsman has done some positive things. He has tried to help some political prisoners and help their improve their conditions, but he is still clearly a government official. And so he alone cannot change the track of things going, but if he were to take a more public opening, he would join the Attorney General, who has already said openly that she that it was unconstitutional, the move to intervene, the Supreme Court to intervene in the legislature and take away its powers. And she has called on the government to allow the protesters to be out in the streets peacefully. So if we add to the Attorney General, the ombudsman, if he were to take a position, that would certainly begin to show, you know, cracks in the regime in that sense. And that would be an important momentum.
Well, let's talk about the colectivos, because my understanding is that the government's been using these armed vigilante gangs to basically intimidate protesters and essentially keep them off the streets, and in some cases drive-by shootings, killing people, and routinely beating them up.
Yes. Now, of course, the government says that there are similarly, either armed people causing violence from the opposition side or infiltration. So both sides accuse the other of infiltrating their marches and their efforts to make them look bad. But these gangs actually started as kind of communal organizations, communal groups to help each other. So they started in a very, you know, benign and peaceful way. But some of them have turned into these armed gangs. And in fact, President Maduro said he was going to arm 400,000 more people, or bring 400,000 more guns out to civilians like this. President Chavez had actually started this, creating, in essence, an armed civilian militia to help defend the revolution. And there have been postings of, you know, videos posted on Twitter and Facebook about showing armed people armed on motorcycles shooting another. There was a young woman killed, and that was shown on Facebook. Now, the identity of the actual people, you know, I don't know if they've proven who the identity is, but certainly some people on motorcycles have guns and have shot at least this one person as videotaped.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's a political science professor at Georgia State University. She has directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Jamaica, Peru, and Venezuela, and has spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow. She's the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela, and her most recent book is International Mediation in Venezuela. So today at the White House, Donald Trump has been in talks with the president of Argentina, and he said during the meeting, Venezuela is a mess. Venezuela is a mess. We will see what happens. Not exactly hands-on. Of course, the Maduro government, all they do to excuse themselves from their gross mismanagement of this oil-rich country, which is almost bankrupt and is suffering sort of what, you know, Germany was suffering during the Weimar Republic in terms of inflation, everything is blamed on America. Is that getting tired? Because I don't see, you know, from Trump's remark, I don't see the hand of America in here. This is, why would they want to intervene? And what could they do in any case? Isn't this a case of a government manifestly squandering this oil-rich nation's economy?
Yes, it certainly is. I mean, the government itself has really created this economic implosion. by, you know, not investing, not continuing to invest in the all-important oil industry, by taking over private companies and then being unable to run them, and, you know, just by spending above their means. So this, the Nicolas Maduro still has about 20 to 25% approval within the population in public opinion polls. So he has a hardcore set of supporters who I think do believe him when he blames the troubles on the United States, which he calls the empire, as did Hugo Chavez call it the empire, and the United States stooges. So he also says there are people, you know, in Venezuela, still business owners and the opposition politicians who are the stooges of the United States, and that they are hoarding goods and, you know, contributing to the economic problems. So there is some, you know, important sector that probably does believe him. But overall, the United States, I think that President Trump is taking the right attitude and not trying to be too overbearing, because it does give Maduro this scapegoat. And as I said, certainly at least a fifth of the population, you know, will follow him on that and blame somebody else rather than blaming. But most of the population, I think, is just so tired and frustrated and sick, literally sick, can't get medicine, you know, that they just want something to change. They want somebody to change this. And the United States is joining with the rest of Latin America through the Organization of American States to criticize the situation and to offer help. The United Nations has offered help too, humanitarian help, medicines, et cetera. And I think these are the right things, to try to isolate Venezuela diplomatically, to put pressure on, but to also offer the humanitarian aid that is vital at this moment.
But so far, about 30 people have been killed in these pro- and anti-government demonstrations. And given the presence of these colectivos on these vigilantes, pro-government vigilantes on motorcycles, and you mentioned this probably also armed people on the other side as well, on the anti-government side, but you have to put that in the context, surely, of that this place is awash with arms. It's got one of the highest crime rates in the world, I think, only second to Honduras. So how do we know? I mean, well, actually, I guess the real question is 30 people being killed, given what a tinderbox and how heavily armed the place is and how much it's already under the sway of criminals, couldn't this whole thing disintegrate into total chaos?
It certainly could, and I think there's a real risk there. I would point out that on the opposition side or the protester side, there certainly are youth, mainly young men, who do go out, particularly in the evenings near the ends of the protest, and engage in a sort of battle with the security forces, with the police and the National Guard, not directly with the colectivos. But their arms are Molotov cocktails and throwing back the tear gas canisters, setting fires in the roads to block them. So they don't seem to be using, you know, actual firearms. But you're absolutely correct. Venezuela is a heavily armed population. And so the risk of a high level of violence is there. And I would see this ending up in one of two ways. One is that the opposition is able to keep the people out in the streets long enough, a sustained pressure in the streets, combined with a growing international condemnation and pressure to bring splits within the regime, and at least to break off the more moderates, like the Attorney General, perhaps like the Ombudsman, perhaps some of the military that, you know, doesn't want to end up firing on their own fellow citizens, to start negotiations to bring an end to this situation, which would be negotiations to restore the Constitution, to have elections, and perhaps even to have a transitional government. So that would be, you know, the more positive route. If not, if the population gets too scared or too tired to go out and the protests stop, the international community looks away, then that simply strengthens the government to stay in with repression, still having to rely on repression. And we may see, you know, just a continuation of a repressive situation while they hold on, waiting for oil prices to continue to rise and try to muddle through. And I think they, you know, their interest in that is because they in particular do not, some of them who have been involved in illicit activity, criminal activity, drug trafficking, don't want to risk being out of power or losing power in elections and then being subject to recrimination, to imprisonment, or extradition to the United States. So some kind of negotiation to provide a form of transitional justice, that is some form of reduced sentencing, is probably going to be required if the first route of negotiations is going to work.
And in terms of the OAS, the Organization of American States, 19 of the 35 members called for a special meeting in Washington on Wednesday. They call for this meeting to look into the current situation in Venezuela, and they want to convene a meeting of the consultation of foreign ministers on the situation in Venezuela. I don't know how quickly that will be done and what their agenda would be, but what are their chances of success? In other words, peer pressure, I guess you could call it.
Well, that's exactly what it is peer pressure. I mean, they don't have much leverage over Venezuela, but what that would mean would be the first step toward their ultimate sanction is simply suspend or expel Venezuela from the OAS itself. And that is more, you know, a political, a symbolic, and a diplomatic gesture. There could be some economic ramifications, though, because one, they'd be clearly stating Venezuela is no longer a democracy, and therefore, you know, economic investors want to take heed, be cautious, and the multilateral banks, like the Inter-American Development Bank, the World Bank, if they were to restart loans to Venezuela, if Venezuela wanted to seek help in terms of loans, those would be affected by a suspension from the OAS.
So in the meantime, just to wrap up, you've got a tinderbox, the possibility you could have all-out violence. You've got a sort of boneheaded guy like Maduro under siege. A lot of his cabinet members are crooks, so they don't want to face justice. What's your prediction? Is it going to get worse before it gets better?
It probably will. It probably will get worse. I hope that it does not deteriorate into a spiral of violence, but that enough cool heads and people, you know, committed enough to the nation as a whole and not to their own particular group or political party will win out and have the courage to begin to talk about how to move this country forward in a peaceful way and restore democracy and certainly to deal with the really dire problems of the shortages of food and medicine.
Well, just in closing, I have friends there, and they've been reporting about that, and they've also had neighbors murdered in their beds, they've been mugged, they're worried about their own lives and their children. So, you know, I feel terribly for these people.
Yes.
Well, Jennifer, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you too, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's a political science professor at Georgia State University. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Jamaica, Peru, and Venezuela, and spent time in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Uruguay as a Fulbright Fellow. She's the author of The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela, and her most recent book is International Mediation in Venezuela. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.